Joining us in this segment is investigative journalist William Turner. William Turner began his career as an FBI special agent in 1951, and for 10 years he was schooled in the art of criminal and counter-espionage investigations. He pulled off illegal burglaries and garnered accolades from J. Edgar Hoover along the way. Eventually, however, he became disenchanted with Hoover's despotism, his misplaced focus on the communist menace, and his reluctance to tackle organized crime. When Bill Turner decided to leave the FBI, he exchanged his revolver for a typewriter and wrote a classic expose, Hoover's FBI, which went off like a bombshell. To those of you in the audience old enough to remember J. Edgar Hoover, you will have to be impressed by the fact that while he was a special agent of the FBI, William Turner stood up to its director and lived to tell the tale. This is no mean feat. For over a five-decade period, as presidents came and went, J. Edgar Hoover was a constant over at the Justice Department heading the FBI. I have to take a minute to quote from the introduction to the 1993 edition of Hoover's FBI as Turner tells a story about appearing on the Joe Pyne Show back in 1968. Pyne was more or less the Rush Limbaugh of his day, actually much nastier than Rush Limbaugh. Turner appeared on the show, was being badgered by Pyne, who at one point said to him, 100 years from now, who are people going to remember, Bill Turner or J. Edgar Hoover? To which Turner shot back, why, Hoover, of course. He'll still be director. Now, as mentioned, after leaving the FBI, William Turner became an investigative journalist. One of the things he investigated was the assassination of Robert Kennedy. He wrote a book titled The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy with co-author John Christian and attended this commemoration in Los Angeles that took place last weekend. He returns to our show today, and we're privileged to have him. William Turner, welcome once again to Radio Parallax. How did you get involved in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy?
Well, I had run for U.S. Congress in the Democratic primary in San Francisco in the same election that Bobby Kennedy was running for the Democratic nomination for the President of the United States on an anti-Vietnam War plank. And I, too, was opposed to the war, but I also wanted to introduce the idea in Congress of reopening the John Kennedy assassination case. I advocated reopening the JFK case, and then the slug on my brochure read, not to do so not only is indecent, but may well cost us the life of a future president of John Kennedy's instincts. So I was kind of stunned when on election night and the returns came in and Bobby Kennedy gave his victory speech that he would be shot in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, where he had just said, on to Chicago and let's win there. And he was an odds-on favorite to grab the nomination from Hubert Humphrey and defeat Richard Nixon in the elections that fall. So at first, I was like most people, here he is, Saran, caught red-handed, with the gun in his hand, the smoking gun. He had fired 8 shots, and everybody thought that was it. It was a cut-and-dried case, and so did I, until one of my attorney friends introduced me to a man who claimed that he had picked up Saran hitchhiking on the day of before the election, and that they had consummated a deal where this Jerry Owen, the preacher, who was a friend of the attorney, he would provide a lead pony for Saran to use at the Santa Anita racetrack. Well, the problem with the story was he was to collect the $300. He was supposed to show up with the pony at the rear entrance to the Ambassador Hotel on election night. And I knew that was a cock and mamie story. But he had some reason for wanting to disguise a prior association with Saran. So that started me on the investigation into what really happened.
So you were right away looking at the possibility that Sirhan had accomplices or other people were involved.
That's correct.
And we should clarify that that you, like everybody else, admitted then and admit now that Sirhan was certainly shooting at Bobby Kennedy in the pantry that night.
He was shooting at Bobby Kennedy in the pantry that night. I mean, there were too many witnesses, and the ballistics show that he had an 8-load Ivor Johnson revolver. The L.A. Police Department accounted for all 8 shots, one lost in the ceiling interspace in the pantry. The 7 others removed from the bodies of the various victims, including the one death, which was Senator Kennedy.
You know, there's an odd thing about that case, and we probably want to mention just briefly, that after the shooting, Bobby Kennedy and the 5 other people who were struck by bullets were taken to a police hospital to get x-rayed before transferred to the emergency room. I don't think in 20 years of medicine I've ever heard of anything like that.
I can't understand them taking it to a facility like that to triage them. I mean, they can tell the severity of the wounds. They all needed emergency room attention, and they could triage them at the emergency room. I don't know why they had to take them there to do x-rays. The only explanation is the police wanted to find how many bullets were fired that night.
Well, I remember contemporaneous news accounts referring to the fact that Kennedy had been killed by the shot that came behind him, 1 to 3 inches behind his head. He was struck by 2 other bullets that were from the right and behind him. When the autopsy came out, it would appear that it would exonerate Sirhan as the killer.
Okay, there's the arithmetic and the geometry. The arithmetic is that more bullets than 8 were fired in the pantry that night. We know that because Coroner Noguchi in his crime scene search is pictured circling a bullet hole in the panel of the wall, which incidentally was removed and routinely destroyed, according to the LAPD. The pantry door divider had a bullet hole in it. Officers from the LAPD are depicted in an AP wire photo picking a bullet out of the stairs from which Bobby Kennedy descended into the corridor from the stage to the pantry. William Bailey, an FBI agent who responded to the crime scene search, said that there were extra bullets.
So we know that Sirhan's gun had 8 bullets. We have 7 bullets accounted for in victims.
Right.
We have 1 hole in the ceiling, 1 in the wall, 2 in the divider between the pantry, and 1 in the stairway.
Right.
That is an arithmetic problem.
So there you got at least 3. And what we did, I mean, Vince Bugliosi and myself and others were involved in having Dr. Michael Hecker of the Stanford Research Institute, who had done the Nixon White House tapes audio analysis, doing an oscillograph and spectrographic analysis of the shots fired in the pantry that night. There were 3 tapes. One was an ABC open mic. The other was a Mutual Broadcasting Systems reporter, recorder going. And the third was Jeff Brand of another network. So there were 3 tapes available that had captured the sounds in the pantry on that night. And Dr. Hecker lined them up and came to the conclusion, eliminating anything that might have been the sounds of a balloon bursting or a folding chair falling, and identified them qualitatively and quantitatively as gunshots. He gave us an affidavit that there were at least 10 gunshots fired in the pantry that night, so that's 2 more than Sirhan could have fired. The geometry of the situation is that Coroner Noguchi in his autopsy detected powder burns on the back of Bobby Kennedy's head from the fatal shot, and the fatal shot was fired from the rear at a distance of 1 to 3 inches according to the powder tattooing. Sirhan never got closer than 1.5 to 3 feet from the front, so he could not possibly have fired the fatal shot.
So it seems quite clear that that when you do the math and you find a confirmation of 3 different audio tapes confirming the mathematics of tallying up the number of bullet holes and bullets in the victims, that that there was more going on than Sirhan's pistol.
Absolutely. There had to be at least a second gun in the pantry that night.
Now, you mentioned the problem of geometry. In Kennedy's case, that all of the shots came from a very abrupt angle, almost from the floor to the ceiling, 80 degrees to the body axis.
Right.
And by all accounts of the many people in the pantry, Sirhan's gun was held stretched out arms, horizontal. It was immediately slammed down onto a steam table. It never got to where it could have been firing from a low to high angle.
That's correct. He accosted Kennedy from the front, and when I say 1.5 to 3 feet, I'm talking about the gun itself in his hand, not his body. So that's as close as he got, and bullet fired from the rear at an upward coursing angle, like you say, had to be fired by a second gun.
We're speaking with William Turner, ex-FBI special agent, investigative journalist, and most recently author of Rearview Mirror, looking back at the FBI, the CIA, and other tales. Now, on the night of the assassination, word went around the world that a credible witness had seen someone fleeing the scene, a woman in a polka dot dress with a taller man, saying, "We shot him. We shot Kennedy." She had previously seen those two individuals and someone who resembled Sirhan enter the building.
That's Sandy Serrano, who was a worker for Kennedy, a young lady that was very involved in the campaign. And she had gone out on a fire escape. Remember, this is an old building. Had an outdoor fire escape. And she saw the pair come, a man and a woman, enter past her. She was out taking the smoke. Then she heard the sound of gunshots, and only the woman came back down the fire escape, and she was saying something about, "We shot Kennedy, we shot Kennedy." So that was the girl in the polka dot dress, who other witnesses in the pantry had seen there before the shooting, close to Sirhan, as if prompting him. Now, Sirhan, when I interviewed him in San Quentin prison after his conviction, he told me that he didn't remember anything from the time in the Ambassador Hotel that evening when he met a girl in a polka dot dress that he hadn't met before, that she wanted was by a silver coffee urn, that she wanted heavy on the cream and sugar, and that from that point on, his mind was a blank until he was overpowered in the pantry. So he's claiming amnesia over the period of the crime.
Does that seem credible to you?
Well, I explored the possibility. One of the defense expert witnesses was a Dr. Bernard Diamond from the University of California at Berkeley. And Dr. Diamond was a well-known forensic psychiatrist, and he was hired from the by the defense, which was putting up a diminished capacity defense, admitting that Sirhan had shot him. But according to Dr. Diamond's testimony at the trial, he found that Sirhan was highly susceptible to being hypnoprogrammed. He could snap his fingers and put him under and have him climbing the bars of his cell like a monkey. So Dr. Diamond concluded that at the time of the crime, Sirhan was in a hypnotic state. But then he went on to say that it was probably self-induced by all the lights and mirrors in the Ambassador Hotel. Well, I talked to the prison psychologist at San Quentin Prison, and he had spent a lot of time. His name was Dr. Edward Simpson Callis. He was European trained, and he was used to the European recognition that hypnoprogramming was an actual fact. There was a Copenhagen case to prove it.
Could you take a moment to tell us about that case? When I read your book, excellent book, Rearview Mirror, your chapter on that, and I was quite surprised to find out about that case.
Well, the Copenhagen case in the 50s, there were two cellmates, and the one cellmate was released early in the other. He had hypnoprogrammed the weaker of the two cellmates to go out and rob banks and bring him the receipts. To hypnoprogram and have somebody act against their normal impulses, you have to ascribe a high moral purpose. And in this case, the high moral purpose that was used by the programmer was the unification of all Scandinavia. So the Copenhagen authorities, after the perpetrator robbed a bank and killed a person and was captured, he couldn't remember who programmed him. so they called in the psychiatrist to work with them over a period of several months and finally found the key to unlock the blocking mechanism that had prevented him from telling. And sure enough, it turned out to be his cellmate. The cellmate was thereafter convicted of the crime, and the perpetrator was let loose.
Well, it sounds like science fiction. It sounds like something out of The Manchurian Candidate.
The Manchurian Candidate was based on the CIA's MK-Ultra, Mind Control Ultra program of the 1950s, which had to do with combating the Soviets and mind control. And there was a subsection called Artichoke, which had to do in hypnoprogramming somebody to kill.
Well, that in itself is worthy probably of a discussion in its own right. Perhaps you can come back and we can delve into that in the future. The movie, they're remaking, evidently, The Manchurian Candidate.
Tina Sinatra, Frank Sinatra's daughter, and Frank was a star of that movie, is remaking it, and it should be out before release this year.
About that time, we ought to come back and talk about this subject once again, where fact meets fiction, and it's a stranger story than I think most of our listeners even know about.
I think we can revisit it, Doug.
Well, excellent, Bill. Just to review today, then, to most people's surprise, I think the autopsy evidence in the Bobby Kennedy case exonerates Sirhan as the killer. Although he certainly was firing a gun that day, the physical evidence at the scene suggests that there are more bullet holes in victims and the surrounding building than there were in his gun.
Right.
The audio evidence confirms that there were more than eight shots. We have credible witnesses of accomplices before, during, and after the shooting. And Sirhan appears to have something very strange going on, call it brainwashing, whatever, in his background before of the incident.
Truth is stranger than fiction.
Apparently so. Lawyer Lawrence Teeter is moving for a mistrial or a retrial of Sirhan on that.
He wants an evidentiary hearing, both on the Manchurian Candidate theory and the extra bullets and the geometry of the case. So he's been trying to get a evidentiary hearing, which would then set the stage for a new trial if the prosecution keeps insisting that Sirhan was actually guilty of premeditated murder.
Well, we'll be talking to Mr. Teeter and the show in the future, and I think that that'll be very fascinating to address the legal issues in this.
Yeah.
Before we go today, the one thing we should mention, there is one loose end we may mention. We do know of a gun located in exactly the right position, that is, behind Robert Kennedy to the right. We know that the person who had the gun in his possession admits to pulling it out of his holster, and we have eyewitnesses that say that he was firing the gun that night. We probably ought to mention him.
St. Eugene Caesar is a person of interest, certainly. He was a uniformed security guard at Bobby's right rear and in a position, certainly, to fire the fatal shots. And there's a lot of defugally about when he sold his .22 caliber pistols. If the case is reopened, Mr. Caesar would be a prime subject to be interviewed.
Well, William Turner, thanks so much for talking about the Robert Kennedy case, and we look forward to talking to you in the future about ongoing developments.
Okay, Doug, thank you.
We're privileged to have William Turner on this program. I'd like to read you a quote about what movie director Oliver Stone had to say about his work. Turner's stories, like movies, work in three dimensions. A complex bureaucratic paper chase becomes a tale of human foibles and agendas. Names, dates, and places are imbued with personalities, backstories, and most of all, Turner's marvelous eye for humor and the human condition. And despite the relative lack of happy endings in Turner's pieces, the reader comes away empowered with renewed understanding that history and politics belong not to some select few, but to all of us. Thank you once again, William Turner, for coming on our show. We look forward to speaking with you again in the future. Now, Mr. Edward McMillan, my sound engineer, and myself traveled down to L.A., as I mentioned last weekend, for this commemoration of Bobby Kennedy's assassination. And we obtained a most interesting interview with Sirhan's attorney, Lawrence Teeter. We'll be airing that in the weeks to come, along with interviews with Jim DiEugenio and Lisa Pease, who were the editors of Probe magazine. Their book, The Assassinations, which is a compendium of materials that appeared in Probe magazines, is available in bookstores and talks about the political assassinations that changed American history back in the 1960s. Look forward to talking with them in the future. But I wanted to close this segment with what was probably the most memorable part of this trip to Los Angeles, a field trip that we made over to the Ambassador Hotel. Lisa Pease took Mr. McMillan and I a couple blocks from the Radisson, where the conference was being held, over to the Ambassador Hotel. Now, the Ambassador has not had any guests since 1989. It's currently in the hands of the Los Angeles Unified School District, which is trying to decide what to do with this heirloom building. Currently, it's being used as a movie set for hire. Now, it so happened that last Saturday, a dance troupe from UCLA was putting on a performance in the Ambassador. So, rather unusually, it was open to the public, at least some of the public, that night. We showed up late for the dance performance, but thanks to the kindness of some of the UCLA dance troupe people, we were nevertheless able to walk around inside for a few minutes. It's a truly magnificent old building on a 23-acre site up on a hillside near downtown Los Angeles. The only commemoration for Bobby Kennedy was someone had come by and placed a picture taken a few minutes before his assassination, the high point of the campaign of 1968 when he just won the California primary moments before he was shot. A picture was placed along with a rose, and someone had written next to the picture, "Bobby, we miss you." I found that rather touching, but was saddened by the fact that there wasn't something more to commemorate the terrible tragedy that had taken place 35 years ago. We were not able to obtain access to the pantry area where the murder took place, but you know, that was just only one small part of the Ambassador Hotel's history. I mean, if walls could talk, I mean, what stories they would tell. Six Oscar ceremonies were held in the Ambassador. The Coconut Grove Nightclub was L.A.'s premier night spot for decades. Everyone from Judy Garland to Barbara Streisand sang there. The night that that Gone with the Wind won the Oscar in 1940 for the 1939 film year, the awards were given at the Coconut Grove. Every U.S. president from Herbert Hoover to Richard Nixon stayed there. Nixon, in fact, wrote his Checkers speech while at the Ambassador. Apparently, also, F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote The Great Gatsby while staying at the magnificent hotel. The Los Angeles Unified School District is considering retaining the property, not knocking it down, preserving it for use in the school. I certainly hope that they do. The nation's press is watching to see what's going to happen. They're going to issue a report sometime in June this month on what their plans are. There are only two comparable sites in the nation to the Ambassador Hotel, the Texas School Book Depository building in Dallas and the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis, where Martin Luther King was assassinated. Both those buildings have nothing like the intrinsic significance of the Ambassador Hotel, and they've been preserved as museums. I hope the Ambassador can be kept around. Let's take a break. I'm your host, Douglas Everett. You're listening to Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM.